Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Net at Night is brought to you by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting. This is Net at Night with Amber MacArthur and Leo Laporte. Episode 24 for June 12th, 2007. Boing, boing.
Don't know why I can't sleep. 3 a.m., 43 degrees. TV's on, watching tech TV. Another blue screen of death. I got your email address from the hyperlink on your MySpace. Asked for a Gmail invite, and you replied the next day. How are you? How's it going? Everybody says hello. For help, yeah, we miss you. You're so popular, you know. Everybody wants to be with Amber. Everybody wants to be like her. Everybody surfing in Toronto.
It is 1700 in California. I'm Leo Laporte from Petaluma.
And I'm Amber MacArthur from Banff, Alberta.
And it's even later there, but not as late as it would be if you were in Toronto. What are you doing? Hello, Amber.
Hello, Leo. It's good to talk to you.
What are you doing in Banff?
I am here for the Next Media Conference, which is a pretty cool conference that's been going on for a few years. And what it is a conference that talks about the future of entertainment on the internet. And they have amazing speakers here. I flew in on Friday morning and then drove up to Banff from Calgary. And I've been here for a couple of days shooting for City TV and hanging out with some friends, some people who you know, Leo, of course. On a couple of panels and hosted a luncheon. And it's just been, you know what conferences are like, Leo. It's nonstop action.
So is this a Web 2.0 conference?
It is a little bit like that, but it's more about content. So it's really more about entertainment on the web, such as video. So, for example, so far I've interviewed the president of Current TV. I've talked to the executive producer of Lonely Girl 15, who's here from Los Angeles. Talked to one of the founders of the Guerrilla News Network. And so it's a lot more about content, I think, than it is about sort of software and the technology.
So tell me a little bit about the events you've gone to or the conferences you've gone to.
Yeah, well, for the most part, I mean, I've been on some panels. I was just on a net neutrality panel. There were about five of us on that. You know, this is something I talk about all the time because we always have such crappy connection on Skype. And it was neat. We had a net neutrality town hall. So there were five of us on the panel, a bunch of people in the audience. And what we did is we really got interactive with the audience and gave the mics to people in the audience to talk about net neutrality. And of course, you know, the ironic thing is that, you know, most people who are there are people who understand net neutrality and are for net neutrality and support it. So we all kind of agree with each other. It was almost like a bit of a session where we could all just unload all the feelings that we have about large telcos possibly throttling bandwidth.
Are you being diplomatic at all in this, or are you worried about your job at all, shall I say?
You know, I'm not too worried about it. I feel as though, at least from my standpoint on the panel, it really was someone, I was there as a reporter who was trying to cover net neutrality in mainstream media. And what I had said is exactly what happened to me. I did a story on net neutrality in March, and I tried to get people from Bell and Rogers to speak to me. They wouldn't speak to me. They wouldn't return my phone calls, especially Rogers. And I just wanted to open up the dialogue and try to figure out, you know, what their stance is and what they're doing. And are they throttling bandwidth on Skype? And if they are, is there a way that I can possibly pay more money to get a better connection, because I'm, you know, open to ideas and discussion. And so that was my stance on being at the on the panel.
Well, we do have better. I have to say we're getting a little bit better Skype from Banff. I don't know if that's an indicator or not.
It's an interesting sign. So so that was the last thing that I did. And of course, you know, aside from doing some interviews, which we can talk about in a bit, Banff is absolutely beautiful. I went up in the gondola to the top of one of the mountains and shot some stuff up there. And just an amazing place. Have you ever been, Leo?
No, I haven't. But I've been looking at your pictures. Just, I mean, the mountains in the background. Now, it's not, people aren't still skiing in the middle of June.
No, they aren't skiing, although it's a little bit cool. There's no one skiing, but there's a lot of hikers around. There's a lot of people here. And this conference, Next Media, actually overlaps with the Banff World Television Conference, which is starting tonight. And so you have people here now from all over the world, which is really exciting. But it's interesting because what you're getting is television executives who have come here to buy programs, and there's people pitching programs, and it overlaps with all the new media people. So you have all of these kind of geeks who are, you know, mingling with all these people in suits. And so it makes for interesting conversation.
I understand you talked to the president of Current TV, which is kind of a mix between old TV and new media.
Yeah, it really is. You know, Current TV is interesting. I haven't watched a lot of Current TV, but, you know, it seems like they are definitely doing a great job in taking content that is produced and put on the web. But then they also have Current TV as a broadcast television network. And, you know, they're backed by Al Gore, so they do have money. And I think if anyone's going to be able to kind of make a difference and do some interesting stuff, I think they have a good chance. And one of my favorite interviews that I've done so far is with Greg Goodfried, who's the executive producer of Lonely Girl 15.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, that was really fun. And it turns out that, I don't know if they've announced this all over the place, but they are going to have a new production that's done by LG 15, which is their production company. And they have a new sort of lonely girl that is a girl in London, England, and they're calling her Modern Kate. I know. And that will launch in July. So it's going to be on Bebo. So they plan to, you know, possibly try to get an entirely new audience with Modern Kate. Although Lonely Girl 15, she's obviously still quite popular. And the way that they plan to get revenue in their program, from their program, is really by product placement within the ad or within the show. And you already see that with Lonely Girl 15. They have Hershey Icebreakers gum in the actual show on YouTube. So that's their plan down the road. And he was just a great guy, really interesting. Talked a lot about how they started Lonely Girl 15 and how he was actually feeling very kind of, I don't want to say frightened, but he told me this story about how people were trying to find out who Bree was, the girl in Lonely Girl 15. And they tried so hard that they were tracking down all this information about him and his family.
Wow.
They were getting personal information about his sister. They were calling up, you know, relatives of his. And he felt just absolutely bombarded because it became a very personal attack with this entire like internet population who wanted the truth about Lonely Girl 15. But they kind of just kept on going and got through that and continued to do well.
Did he say what his plan was at the beginning with Lonely Girl 15? Is this how they wanted it to be?
I think his plan at the beginning, that they had no idea that it would ever be this big. It was something they were experimenting with. His background is as an entertainment lawyer, and so he had a lot of experience just in the entertainment world, but not from the standpoint of a content creator. And so they didn't plan for it to be this big, but they just had an idea, and there's four of them actually on the team, including his wife who works with them. And they had an idea, and they thought it would work, and then they did auditions to find Bree, who's played by an actress, Jessica Rose. I think he was actually about 18 or 19 years old. She had never acted before, and
really?
I didn't realize that. Wow. Yeah, she really had no experience in acting at all. And they just loved her character so much. If you've seen a lot of the videos, you know she has great facial expressions.
Mm-hmm.
She does a lot of really interesting things, but they found her, and now she's in a new movie with Lindsay Lohan. So
she's, you know, a star.
She's a star, and that's only 12 months later. It's really not a lot of time. And Greg was saying that one thing that's interesting about Jessica is that unlike other young actresses who have been in Hollywood forever and had the spotlight turned on them, Jessica's had all of this fame on the internet, and it's happened so quickly that, you know, she's just totally overwhelmed by the experience and kind of trying to take it all in.
Yeah. Wow.
So really, I had a fun interview with him, and also the creator of the Save the Internet video on YouTube, and which I'm sure you've seen, is called Independence Day. So he works with Save the Internet, and he talked a little bit about his video on YouTube, which has been viewed more than 3 million times.
They're trying to promote net neutrality, right?
It's exactly. Yeah. Exactly. He won a Webby Award for that, which I didn't realize. In June, he won a Webby Award, and pretty excited about that. He's from Montreal. And I guess the fourth person I interviewed was Josh Shore, who is one of the co-founders of the Guerrilla News Network. And that's kind of an underground socially conscious news network that started a few years ago. And it's fun when you get face to face with these people. I'm sure you've met lots of these people, Leo, but I find sometimes in Toronto, I don't really get the chance. He had a very interesting story about how they started up, and he was actually in Montreal at the time and got a call from Peter Gabriel, who runs an organization called Witness, who was interested in getting involved in a socially conscious news network. And that's how it actually all started. So you end up finding out these quirky little stories about how things actually happen.
Yeah, very interesting. We've got a great guest tonight, by the way. You're a fan of Boing Boing, aren't you?
Yeah, I would have to say Boing Boing's my favorite blog. I absolutely love it. You kind of got me hooked on it because you had been friends with, or are friends with, Cory Doctorow.
Right.
He'd been on Call for Help. And yeah, definitely my favorite blog. I love them. It's a staple in my internet life for sure.
Boing Boing is a collaborative blog, one of the first. Mark Frohnfelder is one of the founders, along with Cory Doctorow, Jeannie Jardin. And let's get Mark on the line right now because he has a new book coming out. And I'd love to talk to him. So we're going to dial Mark Frohnfelder in right now. And he's in Los Angeles. Hey, Mark, how are you?
Oh, fine. How's it going?
It's great. Welcome to Net at Night.
This is Amber.
Yeah. So you know, I don't have to introduce Amber. You know Amber.
Yeah, sure. I've never met her, but I mean, I'm just familiar with her voice from listening to the show regularly.
Well, it's nice to meet you over Skype.
We're big Boing Boing fans. What was the idea? How did that come about?
Well, Boing Boing actually started in 1988.
What?
I know that sounds
there
a little weird.
There wasn't an
but
internet then. There was no internet.
There was no internet that I had access to at that time. But it started as a print zine, actually, that my wife Carla and I started when were interested in things like cyberpunk science fiction and brain machines and underground comics and a lot of the same stuff that's on the blog now. And so, you know, it was a pretty popular zine, actually, and we got the circulation up to about 17,000. And, you know, we were actually making a business of it. And then I got hired to work at Wired, and Carla continued to do it. And then around 1995, a bunch of magazine distributors, went out of business, and they, like, ended up owing us a whole bunch of money and stuff. And so we decided to take it online. But it really took off when it became a blog. You know, that's when it became popular. I wrote an article about web blogs for the Industry Standard in 1999 and really became fascinated with them. And ironically, the Industry Standard didn't want to run the article because they thought that blogs were just a flash in the pan, which is funny. But
just
podcasts,
just like the internet, it's all going away someday.
Yeah, exactly. So. Yeah. Yeah, you know, it was that time. And I started using Blogger at the time, and it was just such a great way to quickly publish stuff rather than, you know, I think that's just the inertia of having to, you know, write something and FTP it and change the HTML and all of that. The cool thing about blogging is, you know, it's just software that makes it easy to publish.
Right, right. When did you bring in Jeannie and Cory? I mean, how did they get involved?
Early on, like just a few months after I started Boing Boing, things were going pretty well. I was getting a few hundred visitors a day, but then I posted something about the Segway. There was an announcement that this guy got a book deal with Harvard Business Press to write about the secret invention of Dean Kamen's.
Right.
And
it.
I went and looked.
Ginger.
The code name Ginger. So I went and looked on the patent database and saw this, you know, something that looked like a guy riding on one of those old push lawnmowers, a little patent drawing. So I posted that, and CNN posted the picture and linked to Boing Boing that night. So I got like 6,000 visitors.
Wow.
And I was really excited. And I said, oh, man, Cory, I'm about to go on vacation, and I want to keep Boing Boing going because, you know, it's starting to get some attention. So while I was away on vacation, Cory took over, and he started like blogging 20 or 30 posts a day. It was like blowing my mind because I usually just did like two or three things a day, and that really like got the readership to swell. So when I got back, I said, you know, just keep on doing it with me, Cory.
Yeah.
And then we picked up David Peskovitz is an old Wired pal of mine, Shenny and I had known each other here and there. You know, she's from Los Angeles too, and so she was a guest blogger, and we really loved the kinds of things she posted. So it was kind of like picking up members of a band, and then
it is. It's almost the perfect mix. I mean, it is the perfect mix, and that each adds something unique.
Yeah, I think so. There's like a kind of a good overlap of interest, and then we all have our own unique interests too that make a good mix.
I always know when it's a Mark posting. I mean, there's
really?
Yeah, there's a certain thing that you're interested in. Jenny, absolutely, you can always tell it's hers. Corey
too. I think you can tell as well. I find anything to do with digital rights management, and also he's the only one who ever mentions Toronto. So being the good Canadian, I always noted that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and Corey does a lot of stuff about Canadian politics too.
Right.
It sounds like the Canadian politicians are just as corrupt as the ones down here.
I think they're more corrupt, actually.
Except they can hide from the media better up here. That's the problem.
There's lots of big woods in Canada.
Exactly. So when you guys first started, what's the process of actually going through so much content on the web? Did you guys all sit down and just kind of do it on your own and then just start blogging in mass to the site?
Yeah, pretty much so. You know, since all of us are journalists anyway, we spend a lot of time on the web researching, and we come across a lot of things that really aren't part of the articles we happen to be working at the time, and also just, you know, things that might be good for articles later on down the road. But, you know, it's a good place as a good place to post this stuff. And, you know, I sometimes just go back and use it as a backup for me to find article ideas later.
It's like a tumble log. I think a lot of people use tumble logs that way.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's just backup.
What do you use now for content management? It's obviously not Blogger anymore.
No, we're using Movable Type, and it's a really old, creaky version of it, and we're working on upgrading it. But, you know, we have about 35,000 posts, so we want to make sure that we do it the right way. And we're actually going to reintroduce commenting on Boing Boing.
Oh,
that was something we had taken
down
a few years ago because of, you know, problems with trolls. But I think we're actually going to start having a person who's going to be kind of a community manager whose full-time job will be to kind of foster message board.
That's a good idea.
Communication. Yeah.
Is your day job as a graphic artist? I mean, your illustrations are fantastic.
Oh, thanks so much. Well, I don't really have a day job. I do some illustration, and Boing Boing makes a nice income. And then I'm also the editor-in-chief of a technology project magazine called Make.
I love Make so
much. Oh, I love Make, too.
Oh, yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
And Carla, my wife, is the editor-in-chief of its sibling publication called Craft. And I don't know if you've seen that before.
I haven't
but
seen
it looks,
that, no.
It looks just like Make, except it's called Craft. And it's got, you know, kind of urban crafting projects in it, a lot of things that mix technology and crafts together. Or just funny, whimsical things, like a room divider that looks like a giant Uncle Milton ant farm and, you know, crazy stuff like that. So we have a lot of fun. We work, we live in a little suburb of Los Angeles, and we have a guest house that we work in together. And
oh,
then
nice.
Once a month, we fly up north near where you live.
Yeah,
I
the next
think,
time
Leo.
You're in Sebastopol, you got to let me know.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So Make is a brilliant, brilliant magazine. If anybody haven't seen it, it's published by O'Reilly, and it's just you say technology on your time, but it's really almost, you know, just how to hack your life. It's just wonderful stuff. I've always loved it, and it has the same Boing Boing personality. What did you do at Wired? You know, your illustrations look a lot like the illustrations that were on Suck. You didn't have anything to do with that, did you?
No, that was Terry Colon. He was a great illustrator.
Oh.
Yeah, and Suck was good. I started there as an associate editor in 1993.
Okay.
At Wired, and then in 1995 I was the founding editor of Wired Online. And then in 96, I became an editor at Wired Books, which they called Hardwired, which was a book venture. And unfortunately, that didn't do as well as we had hoped. The book market is really tough, you know, and super
getting,
low margins.
Getting worse. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. So then I just, in 1998, I was living in LA again and commuting back and forth, and we had our first baby, and it was so hard that I left and just went freelance, and I've been pretty much, you know, freelance full time since then.
I feel like we're talking, Amber, we're talking to web royalty here, really.
I know. I feel like I have so many questions for you. One question I've always wondered, how do you decide what is fit to go on Boing Boing? Is there any type of filtering process among the team?
Well, not among the team, but I think we all kind of operate under the same principle that if there's something that's surprising or interesting to us personally, then it's good enough to put on there. I really like the quote that Gregory Bateson said, that information is difference that makes a difference. And so if we see something that changes the way we our common sense or you know, changes something that we believe in and surprises us, I love that kind of thing, and I love to share that kind of information with other people. And so that's pretty much, you know, the criteria for us. And we just, you know, follow our obsession and hope that there are enough people out there that share our same obsession. We work asynchronously. We all live in different parts of the country, and Corey is headed back to London pretty soon. And, we get a lot of suggestions from people, and we don't do anything like, say, you know, Corey always gets to cover Disneyland or DRM. Sometimes we'll cover that ourselves, and it's kind of whoever first come, first serve for the suggestions. But we get, you know, hundreds and hundreds a day, so we don't get to post all of them, unfortunately. But so far it's been kind of, you know, chaotic, but a fruitful way to operate.
How has
your traffic grown? I mean, is it still on the up and up?
Yeah, it has grown, but you know, it's harder to see the relative difference. I would say, you know, if we had, you know, 10,000 new readers a month, once you get up to 250,000, 10. Yeah, and once you get up to, you know, 250 or 260,000 daily viewers, another 10,000 a month, it's hard to see that difference. We get about, you know, according to our AW stats, we get about 250 to 300,000 unique viewers a day, and then we have like about 500,000 or 600,000 RSS readers.
Oh my goodness!
It's you know,
it's pretty amazing.
It's pretty big. I mean, but if you take a look at compared to something like Dig, you know, it's still pretty small. Dig is huge. They get, you know, hundreds of millions of.
Yeah, and mostly it's links to Boing Boing. So I think really it's not right. So despite what you've said about the book industry, you're writing books all the time. In fact, you got a new book, right?
Oh, yeah, I do. It's called Rule the Web, and the subtitle is How to Do Anything and Everything on the Internet Better, Faster, Easier. And it's just a collection of all the cool things that I've come across and my friends have come across to help you in your real life by using, you know, online services. So it's everything from, you know, banking and travel and shopping to doing things like creating podcasts and making websites and the best way to make a blog and to protect your privacy, you know, tips for making searching easier. And all my favorite sites and things that I've come across in, you know, the years and years that I've been online.
You were Web 2.0 before Web 2.0 existed.
what do you think of that term
about Web 2.0? Is that a meaningful term to you, or is it just some another fad?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, the guy who actually coined that term is Dale Doherty, the guy who's the publisher of Make Magazine.
Right, right.
He's a really nice guy. I don't know if you've met him before.
I have met Dale, yeah.
I think, you know, the fact that a lot of it is user-generated content, to me that's what Web 2.0 means, is that there's a lot of user participation and creation in the website. It leverages the power of a lot of people each doing a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
As far as people who want to do business on the web or launch their own startup, whether it's a blog or a podcast, is that something that you tackle in the book as well?
Yeah, I do. I talk a lot about the different ways to start a blog with either Typepad or Blogger or Vox, and talk about the differences between all of them. You know, I think I like Vox a lot. There's certain limitations with it. I haven't figured out a way that you could insert your own ads into Vox.
Right,
I know you have
right.
a Vox page, Leo. Have you ever?
I do. No, and it's very limited. But in some ways, for me, that's the appeal of it, because I don't even have to think about it. It's a very easy publishing platform for me. But it is certainly not a good idea for somebody who wants more control over what they're doing.
Yeah.
I mean,
what
that's,
do you,
you know,
use, Amber?
I use Typepad. I've been using Typepad for a while. So I was on Blogger and then mm-hmm. switched to Typepad a couple of years ago. And it's been fine for me for a while. I do love Vox as something I would recommend to someone who said, hey, you know, my mom wants to start a blog, right, or my friend, and they're not that tech savvy. I think it's wonderful. Or for someone who's just, like Leo said, kind of lower maintenance. But I find Typepad works pretty well for me.
I'm a big WordPress fan. The more I use WordPress, the more I like it. I have to say, I've set up several WordPress blogs, and it's so easy to do, and it's so flexible and powerful. Although I'm using Movable Type for the new radio show site. So
mm-hmm.
we like to try everything.
A lot of people have recommended WordPress, and I haven't really checked that out at all.
Yeah.
Are you
casting about for what to put Boing Boing on, or?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, if we're thinking of doing, the newer version of Movable Type, but, you know, we're looking around at, you know, possibly Drupal or WordPress.
I mean, Drupal is very flexible. And if you're talking about building community, I think Drupal is probably the best platform for that. It sure scales well. For somebody with a site as big as yours, I think it'd be mm-hmm. a very good choice.
That's what I've heard. And I heard that, like, blogging is just like a tiny subset of everything that Drupal does.
It has good taxonomies, good ability to blog, but it's really much more than it's a CMS in many.
Leo, all of twit.tv is on Drupal,
right,
which is, I mean, it's amazing. There's tons of content on there.
But we don't do a lot of the community features that we could with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very powerful. Actually, you're there with somebody from Bright, the president and founder of Bright.com, which is a great Drupal developer.
Yeah, I was going to just mention that Chris Krug is here, and he's done such sites as I think he did Ask a Ninja. He just finished the Grateful Dead's website, and they are I think just a Drupal firm. They use Drupal for a lot of, if not all, of their projects. They're based in Vancouver, and they've done a lot of amazing work. I think they have hundreds of clients already, but another huge fan of Drupal. And Leo Lovabot was the firm on the East Coast who helped out with twit.tv,
yeah,
who are also another Drupal firm.
Yeah, Lovabot's great. Well, that's an interesting challenge. How do you find time to do things like that? You're so busy, Mark.
Yeah, well, I for that, you know, if we're going to switch to a different content management system, that's where I would have to give up and let someone else do it.
Yeah.
You know, I have done Movable Type installs before, but I think Boing Boing is just too big, and we have too many plans to do other things with it. And so that's when I finally am going to let someone else deal with it. And, you know, now that we're making some money, we can hire really talented people who can help us out to do that.
Is that hard for you to let go, or are you relishing that? Are you looking forward to that?
Well, it is kind of hard to let go. I think that's why I got interested in computers and zines, because I have control over every single step of the process. You know, with zines, it's great because I love desktop publishing software and just being able to do everything myself and then taking it down to the photocopy place and bringing home with a saddle stapler. It was fun just producing the whole thing from start to finish like that. But I also realized, you know, like things like with Make Magazine, it's such a team effort having, you know, great designers and other editors to collaborate. You get a good team of people and you can do wonderful things. So
I have to work on my ability to collaborate and delegate. I'm with you, Mark. I like to do it. But that's part of the fun of it, especially with technology. And as your book says, you can do it. I mean, you can really do almost anything.
Yeah, it's so cool thinking that, you know, the technology that you have at your disposal is something that a television news station 15 years ago would have been salivating over and would have cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. And now it's like, you know, a $700 computer and a $20 a month internet connection, and your potential audience is millions and millions of people. And really, there's no barrier to entry. The only limitation is whether or not you're interesting.
Yeah. How has the your team with Boing Boing, how has it grown? Is it still just four people mainly?
Yeah, it's the four editors, and then John Battelle is our general manager, and he helps us with business plans and things like that. And
he's,
then
he's
we
the guy
also,
behind Federated Media, which is I think you're probably,
and they sell our ads too. John kind of used Boing Boing as the testing ground for the ads. And so, you know, they've got a great ad sales team and are really helpful with us with discussing, you know, business plans and ideas for new things. And we're working on doing some television, some online TV, and also, you know, some TV stuff with on regular television too. And so they've been really helpful with all that as well.
What, you're going to do a Boing Boing TV show?
Yeah.
What?
We are. We're definitely working on one for online that we'll just do on our own.
Now, but, you did a podcast for a while, Boing Boing Boing. Are you still doing that?
We do it. It's not, you know, we can't get it together like you can, Leo.
Oh, I know how hard it is to get a panel together. It's impossible. It's like herding cats.
But you seem to do it, I mean, on a regular basis, and you get all these people together, and it's great. I think that regularity and you know, giving people, you know, the fact that people know that they can get something on a regular basis really helps a lot. If it's irregular,
people. You wouldn't think so, because the whole notion of podcasting is you subscribe to something, you get it when it's done. But I have to say, because we're all conditioned by broadcast media and by print media, which is all rigidly consistent, I think there is a certain kind of mindset that you just, if it doesn't come out, people get mad at me if Twit doesn't come out.
Yeah, I'll bet they do.
Like I've failed them.
No pressure at all.
Because Net at Night, we missed the last couple of weeks, and I feel that way for Net at Night. You know, we were having immense technical difficulties before the show. We actually, just for people who wonder what happened to the last episode, which we did tape, episode 23, there's the technical difficulty. Amber's Skype just was failing us, and I have still not decided yet whether to put that out. It's kind of an embarrassing show. What do you think, Mark? Should you put out the embarrassing shows? Should you put everything out?
Well, if it's painful to listen to because there's a lot of crackles and echoes and stuff like that, then, you know, better not to. But if there's enough signal in the noise there, then people will put up with it if it's good enough, I think.
My mom always said that the best bakers were good because of the number of cakes they put out on the back step. You know, that they threw out. If you only put out the best cakes, then people think you're the best baker.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if that applies to podcasting.
It might, Leo. Well, maybe not when you do so many of them.
We'll put this one out, that's for sure. I mean, it's such a thrill to talk to you, Mark. I've been a fan for a long time.
It's so much fun talking to you guys, too. I'm a huge fan of both of you. And so
when Make first came out, I immediately called Tim O'Reilly and then talked to some other people, including Dale. I said, this is a TV show. This should be a TV show. This is so brilliant. And I think you were talking to some people. Is there a Make TV show in the works?
Yeah, there actually is. We've been talking to some kind of public television company in Minneapolis, and so
it would be good on PBS. I think that's a natural place for it.
Yeah. I think so.
Pause for Alpo ads. You want to keep moving.
Definitely. So I think that'll happen. And we have this guy Bree Pettis, who has been putting together videos for us. It's called the Make Weekend Project, and he does really fun projects. And I think he's a natural for the host.
He's great. Yeah, I've watched a lot of his stuff.
Oh, cool.
Where do you see him, Amber?
Well, when I was at G4 Tech TV doing the show Torrent, where we put video podcasts on television, so we used quite a few brief segments, and then I just ran into him at conferences here and there. But he's funny and informative and entertaining all at the same time, which is a great thing for TV.
Not an easy thing to do. Yeah.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy.
Well, it's just, you know, the thing I always wonder about Make, it's like the old popular mechanics, where you wonder if people actually make the projects or just like the idea that they could if they wanted to.
Yeah, you know, I really do think that is a lot of it. A lot of people I talk to say that they read it and they love it, and they save them because they know, like, one day I'll do this. And that's a big part. And I think, you know, we try to focus on making sure that the stories tell a story, and they tell, you know, from the personal point of view of the person who is making something. They talk about the failures and the workarounds, and so you kind of go for a little ride with them on how they made something. And so that itself is an enjoyable experience, just reading how the person came up with the idea and the false starts and all that. So even if you don't make something, it's still a fun magazine to read.
Oh, I love it. And I haven't made one thing. Well, actually, we made one. I didn't make it, but Darren Kitchen from Hack 5 has made a couple of things on Call for Help. He made the Steadicam.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that was cool.
That's very popular, and that's such an easy thing because, you know, there's no moving parts.
Right.
It's just some
pipes.
Pipes and, some dumbbell weights or whatever you call those things.
But do you, I mean, for instance, in the first issue of Make, it was this great kite camera that was...
Oh, yes. I remember the cover of the magazine.
Complex. Do you actually look at some of these and go, well, we know no one would ever really want to make one of these, but it's just so cool. We've got to show it.
Yeah. The kite one actually is pretty makeable because it just uses a disposable camera that works with silly putty and rubber bands. And it does a really good job of clicking the shutter after you wind it up, like it clicks the shutter about a minute after. One of them that we kind of knew that it would be very challenging for people to make was this guy Joe Grand took an old Atari game console, the 2400, and gutted it and put a mini PC board in there and other stuff. So it was like a MAME, you know, it had MAME emulation, and it would play DVDs and do all sorts of stuff. It was like a fully featured PC inside an Atari 2400, and it was really cool looking.
One in the back of Volume 2, my Atari 2600 Portable, the Benjamin Heckerndorn? This one is a VCS. He made his own VCS, portable.
Yeah, that's right.
That's wild.
We did do like a little... That guy wrote something for us.
He didn't
us,
say how to do it.
Do
he just showed
to.
It. Yeah, he just showed
yeah.
it.
Yeah. And it's kind of a show-and-tell kind of thing that we have. That's we just got back from our Maker Faire a couple of weeks ago in San Mateo, where we had like 300 to 400 people showing off their projects.
I have wanted to go to Maker Faire. Now, I've missed it twice in a row. It sounds like a wonderful party.
It was really fun. 45,000 people came to it.
Wow.
My goodness.
Yeah, it was amazing.
You've got a hit.
You've got to go next time we do it. You would love it.
Is it going to be yearly?
Yeah, it's going to be yearly. And we're also moving it around to different places in October. Well, we'll always have it every year in San Mateo, but we're doing one in Austin in October, and then probably in Europe too in the coming year. Yeah.
Amazing.
When
can we expect something from Boing Boing on TV or on the internet as far as video?
A Boing Boing TV show. I just can't wait.
I do. You know what? It's so funny. The show I do at City TV Web Nation, I was actually pitching it and talking to people about the show, I feel as though it's like kind of like Boing Boing on TV. We wanted that same sort of feel to the show. Stuff is kind of irreverent sometimes.
And, oh, cool.
Yeah, so it was definitely something we focused a lot on. So I can't wait to see what you guys do. Is it something that might launch this summer?
Yeah, I think so. We're hoping to get something, you know, by, I would say, you know, the beginning of August would be when we would start doing something. And they'll just be short things, very similar to the content that's on the website, but just going deeper and, you know, a visual presentation. And we also wanted to experiment a lot with user-submitted videos that we would, you know, edit and incorporate into a show. So hopefully, you know, the Boing Boing reader community will be a big part of this too.
I'm sure they'll love it.
So you are a master of all media. Now you've got your illustration, writing, blogs. You've got a magazine. You've got books. You're going into TV. You've done podcasts. What's your favorite medium, Mark?
You know, I think my favorite medium is actually painting with acrylic paints, because I don't get to do it very often, but I have my first art show in last November, and it was really a lot of fun putting together like 9 paintings for it. It was at a gallery in Seattle, and then I'm working on paintings for 3 different group shows this summer.
Oh,
and it's just so much fun to do that.
What
it's
kind of stuff do you paint in your paintings?
Well, they're kind of, I would say they look like illustrations from children's golden books from the 1950s, except something's a little kind of tweaked with them, a little strange.
You did
Where
a science.
Can you see them?
Yeah, well, you could see some of the illustrations online. I don't know about the paintings themselves. Are they online somewhere?
Yeah, they are. I don't have a URL handy. If you just type in, like, you know, I go to Boing Boing and type something like Mark's painting show.
Okay.
You can see the different paintings.
And you also have this really neat book, which I would love to get, called The Mad Professor.
Oh, yeah, the Bizarre Science Experiments for Kids.
Oh, man, I wish my kids were young enough to get this. How old are your kids now?
I have a 9-year-old daughter and a 4-year-old daughter.
Perfect.
They're fun.
That's the age for this. We've got to get you on our new parenting podcast, Jumping Monkeys, and talk about being a crazy madcap parent.
That would be fun. When did you start that?
Megan Maroney from the Screensavers and I have just started it last week, and it's our newest Twit podcast, and it's really fun to because I'm a parent and she's a parent, and it's something that geeks don't talk a lot about, but more and more of us are parents.
Yeah,
and we have a different insight. We just interviewed Neil of Alternadad, and that was fun. He's got a new site, I'm sure inspired by Boing Boing, but for parents, that is really dynamite. Just great, incisive, fun writing. There's a lot of neat stuff coming out for parents and kids that is not your traditional golden books. It's like you. It's a little twisted.
I'll have to check it out. How old are your kids, Leo?
15 and 12.
So, oh, wow. That's fun.
Oh, it's interesting. They're our teenagers now. It's a really interesting, and it's been a wonderful experience. There, when I asked you what your favorite medium was, I was kind of hoping you might say ukulele.
Yeah, I do. Ukulele, actually, I haven't been playing as much lately. When my second daughter was born, it kind of put a stop to a lot of stuff for a while, and it was just something that I haven't picked up. I'm just starting to pick it up again.
Do you have your ukulele around there? Can we hear a little?
I don't have it here in the office with me.
See, I carry mine with me everywhere, but it's I don't play it, so I just think it looks cool.
What kind do you have?
Oh, I just have a cheap old Hohner, but it's not. You know, the reason I got it is because my in-laws have a Martin, a beautiful Martin.
Oh, cool!
And I was hoping if I got good enough at some point, they'd let me borrow or even have the Martin.
Oh, so, man!
Yeah, a Martin
That's
ukulele.
Great.
Can you? What kind do you play?
Well, I have a Kamaka, which is a Hawaiian ukulele that's a company that's over 100 years old.
Wow.
They're one of the original ukulele makers. You know, the ukulele was started by when the Portuguese came over to Hawaii. They had a little 4-string steel guitar called the Braguina, and the Hawaiians modified it. And a lot of the people that live there were Portuguese in the early days, and they started ukulele companies. But I also have some from a company called Flea Market Music. They make a ukulele called the Fluke and the Flea. And they're,
I've seen the Flea, yeah.
They're really nice. The thing is, they cost about $150. And I've talked to people who own Martin ukuleles, and they say that the Flea sounds better. And they're almost mad about it because, you know,
it's
because
too good.
They are just beautiful. Yeah. You know, it's like, how dare this $175 ukulele sound better than my $5,000 Martin 5K, But that's just, you know, that's the truth. They're just wonderful sounding instruments, and they look like kind of like balalaikas. They don't look like traditional ukes, and that makes a lot of people upset.
They're triangular.
Yeah, they're kind of triangular, and then the flea is smaller, and it's kind of a strange chopped off oval shape. There's something they remind me of, like the Volkswagen New Beetle or something.
They kind of look like a beetle, yeah.
Maybe you could do the theme song for Boing Boing on TV.
That's a great idea.
There's ukulele is hip. It's as hip as can be. I just love it.
Yeah, I love it. It's like the PDA version of a guitar, you know.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
Mark, we want to thank you so much for joining us. It's a thrill and a pleasure to talk to you, and I can't wait to see what you're doing next. Tell us again the name of your new book.
Okay, sure. It's called Rule the Web, How to Do Anything and Everything on the Internet Better, Faster, Easier. And the website is just rulethaweb.net.
I love it. Rulethaweb.net. Cool. Boingboing.net is also, of course, the place to go for the Boing Boing blog. And Make Magazine is online at makezine.com, but you can also buy it on newsstands. And I would say subscribe to it, because every issue I get is there's something just makes you smile or laugh. Or
it's just fun.
It's a great magazine. Rulethaweb.net. Oh, this is cool. Look, and you're putting lots of content up here on the website too.
I was going to ask you that actually.
Yeah, and you know, I've already found a couple of errors in the book. Of course, the errors don't appear until the book is finalized, and then they like jump right out off the page. So I'm going to update that, you know, as soon as I can. But it's such so much fun talking to you both.
Oh, our pleasure.
Listening to you for so long, well, I get to finally talk to you.
We're huge fans, anything you do, I would like to know about. So,
thanks so much, you guys.
Keep up the great
work.
Thank you.
It was great talking to you.
Okay,
and good luck
take
with
care.
Everything.
All right, Mark.
Okay. Hope to meet you soon.
Yes.
I hope so too.
Next time you're in Sebastopol, let me know and we'll get together.
Okay, I definitely will.
Do. Thanks, Mark.
Okay, thanks.
See you later.
Bye.
Mark Fraunfelder, boingboing.net, rulethaweb.net, and Ukulelia is not his site, but it's a site linking from his site, and they can see pictures of the flea uke on there. The world's greatest ukulele weblog, it says. They have a podcast, UkeCast.
My goodness.
I'll be listening to that. Oh, I'm out of tune. I got to work
on it. Do you have your ukulele there?
Well, yeah, of course I do. I told you. It's with me and everywhere. Don't you know it's the PDA of guitars?
I know now.
I love that. Isn't that funny?
Oh, wow. He's great. He's
great
just
character.
Inspiring to talk to you.
Yep. He was Web 2.0 before Web 2.0 existed.
Yeah.
And Amber MacArthur, you are the greatest. I'm glad we could talk to you in Banff. How long are you going to stay at the conference?
Well, you know, Leo, it's funny because ever since I got here, I've had stuff planned, and I actually have to leave early tomorrow morning.
No.
So the last piece of energy that I have left will be to actually get some food somewhere in town and then go to sleep.
All right.
I have to leave in the morning, but it's been wonderful. I took some photos that are up on Flickr, just a few of them with my BlackBerry. But yeah, it was great to talk to you too, and I know that you're coming out to the West Coast of Canada.
I'm off to Vancouver on Tuesday.
Next week. I know. I've had some people trying to recruit me to move to Vancouver, by the way,
yes.
Because there's lots of them here.
Not just me. I'm recruiting you too. Come on. Come on. Vancouver needs you, Amber.
I'm excited that you're having Chris on and also Megan Cole, you know, some really neat people. So
cool.
I'm sure you guys will have some fun.
It's great talking to you. Thanks for joining us, everybody. I'm sorry we're not taking calls. For some reason, TalkShoe, we can't get on right now. I don't know what that's all about. We were streaming this show live on Ustream.tv. Remember, we talked to Brad Hunstable from Ustream a couple of weeks ago. And Ustream, which was having trouble, is now working again. So one works, the other one doesn't. I don't know what we're going to do next week. It's all a great adventure, isn't it?
Adventures in Technology, Leo.
That's what I should call
That'll
it.
That'll be our book.
That's exactly. Amber MacArthur, thanks. Take care.
Thanks so much, Leo.
And we'll see you next time on Net at Night.
Hyperlink on your MySpace. Ask for a Gmail invite, and you replied the next day. How are you? How's it going?
nobody says hello. Call for help, yeah, we miss you. You're so popular, you know. Everybody wants to be